The hour of 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Wolgamont did attend the joint meeting that we had, so Representative Wolgamont, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes from our joint meeting on Tuesday, February 14th, and I would like to move their approval.
Representative Wolgamont moves the minutes from the joint meeting of February 14th. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Coulter, you attended the February 7th meeting. Would you have a motion for us?
I have reviewed the minutes thoroughly and consistently, and I will move their approval.
Representative Coulter moves the minutes of February 7th. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. It's noted that Representative Davids is not here today, so tomorrow or whenever we meet again, he cannot move the minutes the next
yes.
Week.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to have a series of bills today. There's only going to be one bill that we're going to be voting on. I want to draw the members' attention to a memo that I slipped into your file. The memo is an email exchange between Patrick McCormick and myself dated February 24th, 2022, on how we lay bills over and how we don't lay bills over. Just as a reminder, only the chair can lay a bill over. No member can lay a bill over. And we don't even need a motion to lay a bill over. We are in possession of these bills unless we act upon them to go somewhere else. So with that, I want to, she's still first.
Yes.
Representative Kozlowski, House File 381, welcome to the committee, and please present your bill. And I think you have some testifiers, too.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm really pleased and honored to be here presenting House File 381 today. This bill also builds, has been supported and led by both Republicans and Democrats in the past, and that includes Representative Norns, who was lead author of the first bill in 2017 as the committee chair, as well as Representative Kosnick, Rep. Noor, and Rep. Keeler, who previously led this and the higher education portion of the Increased Teachers of Color Act, which is also part of the broader Increased Teachers of Color Act. House File 381 is important for several different reasons, starting with increasing the percentage of teachers of color in Minnesota is needed to close opportunity gaps that exist in higher education and meet our state's higher education attainment goals. As your committee heard from the Office of Higher Education, our state has 75% higher education attainment goal, not only for all adults ages 25 to 44, but also for each race and ethnic group. However, OHE reported that only 30% of American Indian adults, 33% of Latina adults, and 44% of black adults and 64% of Asian adults have attained a certificate or higher credential. The investment in this bill will do much to provide focused support of BIPOC students who are enrolled in teacher preparation programs within Minn State in the U of M system and private colleges and universities throughout the state so teacher of color candidates can be retained and complete their programs. The investments in this bill will also help recruit more BIPOC teacher candidates into preparation programs throughout the state because we know that financial barriers are one of the biggest reasons that inhibit members of our communities of color from deciding to pursue higher education in general and particularly in teacher careers. As we know, a major contributing factor to the gaps in higher education attainment is the opportunity gap in pre-K through 12 schools. Research is really clear on the positive impact that teachers of color could have on student engagement and achievement. Dramatically increasing the percentage of BIPOC teachers in Minnesota is needed to close our wide and persistent opportunity gaps in K-12 schools that are among the worst in the nation. Rather than continue the state's approach over the past 20 years of making relatively small state investments for relatively small but good programs, the Increased Teachers of Color Act does something different. It's a historic and unique shift in the United States in that it's a comprehensive set of interconnected efforts to produce different, bigger, and better outcomes that our state and students need and deserve. For me, this bill is deeply personal, as I know it is to so many, because I'm here before you as a descendant of fierce Mexican and Ojibwe grandmothers who survived assimilation, through boarding school, urban relocation, immigration, exploitation, termination era policies, and more. And my grandmother and aunties are actually known here in Minnesota as the grandmothers of Indian education, working throughout the state to create culturally affirming education and environments for students, families, and educators. And as an Indigenous learner myself, my educators tried but often left me feeling othered, like when I was steered into reading and only writing stereotypically about chiefs from other tribes, when I was called a spick in school and there was no one there to help me understand what that meant or to process it. So having teachers of color means that the next generation of students will not have that experience, and they'll have a clearer path towards their future goals and dreams, where for me, because my community believed I could be the first in my family to go to college, that I struggled to fill out a college application and go through the process. For me, it wasn't until my sophomore year in college that I did have educators of color, people who invested and mentored and nurtured me, people who saw me through really challenging life circumstances to walk across that stage. These are the folks who also cheered me on to pursue my Master of Business Administration and who now lead in administration at my daughter's school, a school that features English and Mandarin and Spanish immersion and Ojibwe immersion, where every single day they receive a culturally affirming education based in the language that was unsuccessfully stripped from our grandmother's tongues and spirits. So to see our kids thrive in a place that was meant to deny our very existence is everything, and it's the legacy that we'll be able to pass on, love for our culture and our people, and also the joy for learning and chasing big dreams that will impact our communities. So the investments in this bill don't just support BIPOC teacher candidates to achieve their personal and professional goals to become teachers and remain in teaching, but our investments will positively impact all the students that they teach. And data shows that all learners benefit from educators of color in the classroom and in our school communities. So again, I want to say thank you for hearing this bill, Chair. And to this committee, I also ask you to look at the handouts that were provided from the Coalition of Increased Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers with really important information about the bill package and relevant data to the programs in this bill. And I do just want to note that we continue to work with OHE to refine the language for the teacher shortage repayment program as well. So now I'd like you to turn it over and hear from our testifier, who is the former Minnesota Teacher of the Year, Jessica Davis, followed by Katia Zapeda, speaking on behalf of the state's Ethnic and Indian Affairs Councils.
Okay, welcome to the committee. And would you come up and please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jess Davis. I began teaching high school mathematics in 2006 at Harding High School. And during my time at South St. Paul Secondary, that I was honored as Minnesota's Teacher of the Year in 2019. I attended 1 through 12 public schools in Minnesota. I hold a bachelor and master's degrees from two of Minnesota's finest institutions. And yet, as a biracial black and white female in the field of STEM, I have never had a teacher who looks like me. These missed opportunities as a student are what motivate me as an educator. I was the only black teacher for almost a decade in my previous district, which has almost 50% students of color. I now serve as a racial equity instructional coach for St. Louis Park Public Schools, where I support other teachers in growing in their growth as culturally relevant educators. The environment is much different compared to my previous experience, as 25% of the overall staff at St. Louis Park are BIPOC. We are creating a space of affinity, a place of safety from the isolation of being the one or only in a district. I believe that the student and teacher experiences are connected and that we as educators are not only responsible for educating future adults, but nurturing a love for learning that inspires students to gain post-secondary education and become the next generation of teachers. Our district enrolls 47% BIPOC students, but less than 15% of their teachers are teachers of color. Although we have a teaching staff that is more diverse than almost all of the suburban districts, most students of color still can't envision becoming teachers because they haven't had any or many teachers who reflect their own diversity. Thankfully, this bill, along with the E12 bill of the Increased Teachers of Color Act, will help change those experiences so that many more teachers who reflect the rich diversity of our students can be recruited, prepared, hired, and retained. fully funding direct financial assistance to teacher candidates and teachers through scholarships, teacher student grants, and teacher loan repayment programs is essential to address one of the biggest barriers to entering and staying in the profession. Teachers are still grossly underpaid for the important work that we do. So helping reduce our debt while earning our licensure is key. Please support fully funding the increased investments as proposed in this bill. They are required to serve the needs of all of our students. Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski, who do you have next on the agenda?
I'd like to invite Katia from the state's ethnic councils.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Katia Cepeda, and I serve as the Legislative and Policy Director in Education for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. As our four councils have done every year since 2017, I am here to share a united message from the three ethnic councils and the Indian Affairs Councils in strong support of the Increased Teachers of Color Act, House File 381, as our top joint priority in higher education. As the slides handout prepared by the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota details, there are only 6% BIPOC teachers in the state, although 37% BIPOC students. Improvements in the pipeline have been made with the percentage of BIPOC teachers prep program completers at 11%, and the percentage of overall BIPOC teacher candidates is at 17%. However, in order to increase the share of BIPOC teachers in the state by just one percentage point, it will require a net gain of 620 BIPOC teachers. Yet, most currently, data show there we're only at 378 preparation program completers. Increased funding for the aspiring Minnesota Educators of Color scholarships and underrepresented student teacher grants is crucial because these scholarships and grants will help recruitment and will support hundreds of BIPOC teachers candidates already in the preparation pathways to finish their licensure program and become teachers. According to OHE's most recent report for the underrepresented teacher, student teacher grant, in fall 2021, grant recipients taught in 7 out of the 8 statewide shortage areas in education. Investments proposed in this bill for the Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program will aid school districts in retaining teachers who are burdened by student debt and low starting salaries compared to other sectors. The impact and power of these strategic investments to tackle shortages of BIPOC teachers and teachers in the shortage licensure areas simultaneously is also detailed with the numbers in the coalition handout. Supporting many more people from our four constituent communities to become teachers will help Minnesota close opportunity and achievement gaps and help our state reach our higher education attainment goals. These investments will contribute to building and diversifying Minnesota's workforce in education and other sectors of the economy. Therefore, we strongly recommend that you fully support the proposed strategic investments needed to ensure positive returns on investments in House File 381. We appreciate the demonstrated leadership by Chair Pawlowski to prioritize hearing this bill and Representative Kozlowski for serving as our lead author. On behalf of the three state ethnic councils and the Indian Affairs Council, we thank you for your leadership in doing what is right for all students in Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski, I have one other individual that had indicated they may want to come down. Laura Mogelson, does she want to come down and testify? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Laura Mogelson, and I'm here from the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Teacher Education, or MACTE. We strongly support House File 381. This legislation represents necessary work to strengthen existing programs and to create new efforts needed to attract, prepare, license, and retain an increased number of teachers of color and American Indian teachers in Minnesota. Three sections we are particularly supportive of are the underrepresented student teacher grant program, the aspiring Minnesota Educators of Color scholarship program, and the teacher shortage loan repayment program. including both the policy improvements and fiscal provisions. Two barriers to earning a teaching license and a degree include the program cost and the loss of income during the student teaching period. There is a significantly greater need than there is funding for existing grant programs to address these barriers. The increase in funding would have a tremendous impact on the lives of individuals and on the goal of increasing the diversity of our teachers across the whole state of Minnesota. I have heard firsthand in my work the stories of many teachers who are graduates of our programs who would not have been able to complete and become teachers without the financial support from these programs. Research shows that over half of educators have significant student loan debt, and that educators of color have significantly more student loan debt than white educators. The proposed programs would support over 2,000 prospective teachers of color and American Indian teachers per year in their licensure program completion, and the loan repayment program could support 2,000 or more per year as well. We strongly support strategies to recruit, prepare, and retain teachers of color in Minnesota. This bill addresses both the severe shortage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers, and it will help us solve the broader problem of the teacher shortage in the state of Minnesota. This legislation will have a positive impact across the whole state on individuals and contribute to the higher education attainment goals, and is a really important investment in our future. So thank you for your consideration.
Members, any questions?
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if OHI will be coming up to present. They're on the list.
If you request them to come down, they will.
I request.
Office of Higher Ed. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Grants and Government Relations for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Oliver, for coming down. I wasn't sure if you were planning to come and present. I saw a handout, but it kind of didn't look like your handout. So I'm wondering if you could just give us kind of a high level of the finances of what we're changing, what we're increasing in this bill. There's several things. And then the most pertinent thing that I have found that I have a question about is we're now creating a special revenue fund. I'm not going to ask the why we're doing a special revenue fund, but maybe you could tell us other instances or other situations that are under the OHI purview that you have special revenue funds, so that we can, you know, almost everyone in here is brand new to the committee, so if you could bring us up to speed there. Thank you, Ms. Oliver.
Director Oliver.
Chair, Representative, to your first question, you're asking what's being kind of funded or changed in this bill particularly. So the one thing that I understand that it is being changed in this bill is the Aspiring Teachers Program is currently a pilot program. So this bill will make that an ongoing program. The other thing is there is requested increased funding for both the underrepresented student teaching grant program, and then there's modifications to the teacher shortage loan repayment program that dictates that a certain percentage of the funding is for to make it proportion to the number, the types of students of color in the field, if I'm correct. The author can confirm that for me. And then there's also increased funding, I think, to that program as well. The second question about special revenue accounts, the teacher shortage loan repayment actually does have a special revenue account. Dual training grants also has a special revenue account, and spinal cord traumatic brain injury program has a special revenue account. I think you had a question about why we might have special revenue accounts.
No.
Okay.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now we're adding, and thank you for that, Ms. Oliver. So now we're adding the scholarship program. The Minnesota Teachers of Color Scholarship Program is now going to also have a special revenue account, I understand. And it also looks like you were saying that the teacher shortage loan repayment program also already has an existing special revenue account. Okay. I just know that we don't have very many special revenue accounts, and maybe you could just inform us, again, because the committee is almost all new people. There's just a couple of us that have served on this committee before. Functionally, how does the special revenue account work, and how is that different from a general fund account, if you could tell us that?
Director Oliver?
Chair. And representative and members, my understanding, and Ken Mike can help out here a little bit, is a special revenue account is the general fund money goes into the special revenue account, and that money is available until spent and does not cancel. So that is essentially the purpose of a special revenue account. My understanding for the ones we do have, for example, spinal cord traumatic brain injury, those projects last beyond a biennium, so we need to make sure the funding's available to continue to pay out those research programs and grants so they can finish their projects. So that's just an example of why we have.
Representative Neal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just one last follow-up, and that is if you could tell us how the pilot project, how the pilot program has been successful, and I have some information in front of me, but I don't know that it's accurate. It doesn't make sense to me. So if you could just let us know how many people have completed and what percentage now we've increased in Minnesota with people of color in the workforce for teachers.
Director Oliver.
Chair and members, the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship Pilot, again, was very new, took a while to get off the ground. We are actually in the process of finishing disbursements of this first round for the pilot program. All eligible applicants are being funded, and there was 206 of those. We've currently only disbursed 184 awards. So I don't have long-term like information about the success of the program as it stands.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one follow-up. I just assumed it was further down the line, because typically, Mr. Chair, as you know, we don't typically move into a full funding of something and away from pilot project until we actually have some results to see sort of what was the net impact of it. So it might be a little premature. I support this program, and I've supported it in the past, don't get me wrong, but I just feel like maybe it's a little bit premature. That's my opinion, that we're moving a little bit too quickly, because I fully expected OHE to say, yeah, we've funded this many, and these are how many candidates have been successful, and this is the percentage increase, but we're not quite there yet. So thank you, Mr. Chair. For
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I've never sat at this table before, and so I am just really excited to be here and hearing about this. I am the mother of five children who don't look like me. They range from 21 to 8, and none of them have had a teacher that looks like them, ever. Not once. And I feel when my now daughter, the teacher of the year from 2 years ago, was Guatemalan. And there was a ceremony for her at our local school board member meeting. My daughter is Guatemala. And we went to that school board meeting, and we sat, and we watched the presentation. And my daughter, for the first time, said, maybe I could be a teacher, Mom. I don't know if she will be. I don't know where the world's going to lead her. But that was such a powerful and moving experience for her. And for me as a mom to realize sitting in that room that none of my children had ever had a picture of themselves providing instruction in the classroom. And as a white parent, I cannot provide that picture either. And so it's important that there are other mentors who look like them in their lives providing that support. And so I just want to say thank you to you for bringing this. I want to say thank you to everyone who has spoken today. And I want to make sure that I'm really clear that just because something takes time doesn't mean it shouldn't be funded as we move it forward. So, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is probably for Mr. Savory, or maybe the bill author knows the answer too. But from my time on K-12 education committees, it seems like we've had testimony in the past on some of these programs where they just can't get people, no matter what the incentive is, to take up the offer, right? And so I'm wondering, And maybe this goes to some of what Representative O'Neill was saying. Maybe these have been pilot programs. And I understand, you know, wanting to move a pilot into a permanent status. But I do think that the numbers should make sense in order to do that. And so I'm wondering if staff, and I know this is spur of the moment, if they have any data on when this pilot program was started and how many individuals have taken part in it, so we could kind of get an idea of the trajectory and how much is there money still sitting there unused. Thank you.
Mr. Savory or Mr. Hubbard?
Chair and members, I can take care of the numerical part. So in the previous higher education omnibus bill in 2021 that was passed in the first special session, $3 million was appropriated on a one-time basis in FY22-23, so split between $1.5 million per year. But that was one time, and there is no base for this program going forward. Should this bill become law, that would establish the base and then move that base also into the tails. So right now, current law were to go forward, the money in 22-23 would essentially cease and stop. It wouldn't carry into 24 and 25 unless a bill or a similar bill like this would change that.
And then Representative Scott. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so I'm looking at the Office of Higher Education's report on the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship Pilot Program, which was dated February 15th, 2022. Now, this program was created in the 2021 Higher Ed Omnibus Law. So this only includes the numbers from fall 2022 disbursements. There was $1.5 million total appropriation in fiscal year 2022. And for fall 2022, the total amount of disbursements was about $750,000. But as Ms. Oliver said, you know, those disbursements are still going out, so this would not be the most recent data.
Well, thanks. That's somewhat helpful. I really appreciate you guys having those numbers. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions, Representative Kozlowski, you want to sum up?
Yes, and thank you so much, Chair. And just really quick, I also just wanted to say that in terms of why you can go, as Representative Hicks, and we've heard that you can go your entire education without seeing a teacher of color is because that the ratio of BIPOC to BIPOC students is 1 in 90, whereas the ratio for white to BIPOC is 1 to 9. And in terms of being able to really look at where it is that we're going and where we need to go, what this transformational program seeks to do is actually move us to a target of 5% of increasing teachers of color by 5% as a starting place, and it would also establish a state goal for annual increases to the percentage of BIPOC teachers with required reporting. So with this investment as a state stepping up and saying that this is what students and families and communities and educators need and deserve, sends a resounding message that Minnesota will have a bright future for our communities to come, and I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. This was the first bill heard in the committee, so you've set a nice standard for everyone to follow.
All right. Let's see how they live up.
Next on the agenda is House File 355, Representative Boehner. She's got another committee going on, so we're going to juggle this just a little bit. I'm going to move that House File 355 be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. They want to take a look at it. Welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to introduce to you today one of the state's best kept secrets, the MHEFA, or the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority. In existence for over 50 years, their mission is to help shepherd, ensure success, and fund worthy projects using their tax-exempt bonding authority for capital projects. This work expands options for non-government or nonprofit entities in the areas of higher education. Their fees are lower than allowed by the IRS and represent a solid value to fund worthy projects that have a broader public benefit. They have proven track record of success born out of over decades of experience. I think they are at year 52 currently. This state agency takes its authority from the state, but it is fully funded, meaning all costs for administration and staffing are paid for out of fees generated by their work, and there is no, I repeat, no cost to the state. The agency is overseen by a board appointed by the governor and with the consent of the Senate. They run a tight ship with two paid staff and billions of dollars worth of successfully executed projects. While the agency has toiled away doing great work over the years, in more recent years, they were approached to use their vast experience for healthcare and senior living projects. While they did not entertain the projects as they were outside of their scope, they realized that there was an ever-growing need to put their talents to use in projects that, like their original scope, go well beyond basic capital and bring projects that meet the greater public good. That brings us here today, and here is what the bill does. First, it changes the name of the organization from the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority to the Minnesota Health and Education Facilities Authority to reflect the newly expanded authority. Second, it expands the scope of the agency to include the ability to finance healthcare and senior living facilities and adds one board member specializing in healthcare. Third, it increases the amount of financing authority allowed by the agency from $1.3 billion to $4 billion to cover its new dual mission. Lastly, it provides clarity that this for the additional $2.25 billion to address the expanded demand of the additional scope for nonprofit healthcare and senior living facilities. In essence, the MHEFA is here today to ask the legislature for permission to apply their extensive skills and low-cost capital bonding authority to meet an increased need within our communities. Members, I ask for your support. You will find in your packets today a full list of benefit summaries for local government, for healthcare and senior facilities, as well as higher education. You will also find a full plethora of letters of support from various institutions, including the Minnesota Private Colleges, in your packets as well. You will also additionally find a fiscal note finding a $0 amount and no cost to the state. And with that, I have before me with me today Barry Fick, who is the head of that agency, to give some additional detail and color.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Barry Fick. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority, and I'm pleased to report and presents to you today some information about the authority. As Representative Bonner noted, we have been in business for 52 years with great success. We currently are able to work with private colleges and universities and have received multiple requests over the past few years to see if we could assist healthcare and senior living. In looking at that, we have put together a package and talked with a number of people in the healthcare and senior living area and believe that we can do a very good job for them, bringing our expertise and the efficiency with which we operate our agency to help those folks with their financings, which will in turn hopefully provide some benefits to smaller communities where they can build, say, a medical clinic rather than a huge facility, builds nursing homes in the community, and also to assist folks with working together and collaborative projects. I've worked on projects previous to my tenure at the authority where we combined a, say, senior living facility with a nursing program at a local college. And so we think there's synergy available over time to do that for us as well. We think this would be a very helpful process. And in addition, would allow us to keep our fees at the absolute rock bottom low that we currently charge. As an agency, we are based not for profit. We don't make money. And so we bill for our services at cost. And as Representative Bonner noted, 100% of the fees associated with operating the agency are paid for by our borrowers. So there is no cost to the state. I would also add any of the bonds that we issue and loan the proceeds to the borrowers are not obligations of the state. There's no general obligation pledge. There's no moral pledge. There's no pledge whatsoever. And we have no taxing power, and the bonds cannot be supported by any taxing power that the state might have. So it's a very, we believe it's a very efficient way to work with the state, and I would urge your support. I would note, especially for those of you who are new on the committee, we were in front of the committee last year as well. The motion was, the committee, the bill was passed unanimously out of this committee and unanimously by healthcare as well, and then was included in the Joint Conference Committee House Senate omnibus bill for higher education that went and was passed unanimously by the House of Representatives, transferred over to the Senate, where the Senate was unable to take action on it as time expired in the legislative session. So we're back with the exact same bill, and there's been substantial support for it, bipartisan support. I know we have Representative Davids and Representative Bonner as our House sponsors. Likewise, we have Senate Republican and Democrat DFL sponsors as well. So I'd be pleased to respond to any questions or comments that committee members might have.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Vayner, just congratulations on a bill. To see how, so for those who are new and maybe haven't had a bill yet, or those who had a couple bills, see how good it feels bringing a bill forward that costs zero to the state? I mean, we're all guilty of bringing bills forward that are good and they cost a lot of money, but for those who bring a bill that costs nothing to the taxpayers, it is it was like an olive branch. It's releasing. It's wonderful. So thank you. And doesn't it feel good, Representative Bonner?
It does.
You want to respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does, Representative McDonald. And I also want to thank that excellent point. I do also want to make sure that I give credit to Representative Davids, who also did some additional work on this before I took up the mantle several years ago. So I just want to make clear that this has been a joint effort, and that we really have worked hard to make sure that this remains bipartisan, so that this authority can be extended to do more great work in the community.
Representative Cleborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bonner. I will be voting to allow this bill to move out, but I do have a few concerns based on conversations that we're recently having in Commerce. So I apologize for not talking to you about this before today's hearing. I am always concerned when people say that we're going to build buildings and it costs the state nothing, and that we're going to do this for nonprofits and we're going to do this for long-term care. I have been doing a lot of research into healthcare facilities, who owns them, and who gets left with the cost of picking up those healthcare facilities once the initial project is done. And the transfer of these properties that start off in a nonprofit and then get moved to private equity real estate investment trusts. So is there any assurance that if we are offering no cost, low cost, using state bonding authority, that these buildings and institutions are not going to be moved into the private equity market at any time?
Mr. Fick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleburne, yeah, none of the transactions we have ever done allows for that sort of a transfer to occur. Because of the tax exemption that we have, if there would be a transfer such as that, the tax exemption would be lost and the bonds would have to be repaid. So we specifically prohibit that from occurring in the transactions we finance.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm finding is that those transfers are in fact happening, and that we now have nonprofits who are paying insurance, maintenance, and taxes, and the ownership of the building is actually being held by private equity. So I just want to make sure, as this bill moves forward, Representative Bonner, that you and I touch base, and that we make sure that I hear that your intention is pure. So I want to say that, and I'm not throwing shade, but I just want to make sure that we are protecting the assets that the state is helping to fund. Thank you.
Representative Cole.
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So there's been a little bit of a lack of clarity here, so I just want to make sure. There is no cost to the state, correct?
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
That was supposed to be a joke. Obviously, nobody got that. Because that phrase was repeated like six times in the last 15 minutes. My serious question is, as I'm thinking about this, of course, the authority was created to assist private nonprofit post-secondary institutions, and now is being expanded. And I'm just curious, I guess, if there's ever been any discussion. I mean, I can think that there would be other nonprofit organizations that would probably love to have a tax-exempt bond status to finance capital projects. I'm just curious if there's been any discussion about what that might look like, even beyond sort of healthcare facilities. I can think, social service agencies and food shelves and so on might have a lot of appeal for other organizations like that. So just sort of curious for those thoughts generally.
Mr. Fick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have talked about that and the possibility of doing other 501c3 financings. Our thought is that with a small agency of only two people and maybe having to add one person as we gear up with the healthcare side, we really would prefer to take a very positive approach to helping the folks, and then as we get an understanding of that, I could easily conceive coming back in a couple of years or so to the legislature to ask for the ability to do all 501c3s. That's not uncommon in other states. Our neighbor to the east, who we don't have to name them, but they have an agency similar to the one that I run, and that agency works with higher education, healthcare, and all 501c3s in that state. So it's not uncommon to do that. Minnesota has not done that historically, but we think it's very appropriate in this case to take a graduated expansion so we can get the expertise, gain that knowledge, and then come back and possibly look at that option in a year or two.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill. I did have a couple quick questions just because I've never heard this bill before. And one of them is on lines 10-12 through 10-18, and it talks about that before issuing the bonds, the authority must get the consent of each city or town in which the project is located, except that consent is not needed in a town with a population of less than 100,000. And I'm just wondering, why is that there? Seems like local control on a project would be important. Thank you.
I'm going to go to Mr. Fick on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reason that is in there is Minneapolis and St. Paul requested that they have that addition, in part because the work that they do with their not-for-profit healthcare borrowers, they charge a fee and they have some substantial revenue for that. So they were concerned that if we came in, that revenue stream would be diverted from them, and so we agreed last year to add this provision in there. With regard to, so it helps them, and with regard to the other communities, most of the communities already have the opportunity or the option to provide tax-exempt financing for healthcare or senior living, either through their city bonding capacity or through the county bonding capacity that they would have at that particular geographic location. We offer an additional option for them, which quite from our perspective has proven to be very cost effective and very effective from an administrative purpose. So for example, an entity such as Hazelden Foundation has multiple geographic locations, and if they would be able to go through us for a financing, they would effectively have a one-stop shop, so to speak, for all their financing, which would allow them to have consistent documents from transaction to transaction, from facility to facility, and make it easier for them. In addition, we have talked actually with a number of local communities who really don't have a crazed desire to do these financings, largely because they don't have the expertise on staff to know what questions they should ask. And so if someone like ourselves would come in with a very thorough vetting process, which we would establish, just like we have a very thorough vetting process for the colleges and universities before we do the financing, that would allow some comfort to the city where the project might be located. I would also add that whatever project is looked at in terms of local control, local zoning requirements and local ordinances would all have to be re- respected and complied with by anything that we would borrow. In fact, our applications for higher education, as would for health care and senior living, require that all the local organizations or local requirements be met before we would do any financing for them.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's enlightening. And, you know, I'm just a little concerned that we're giving a carve out for Minneapolis and St. Paul because of, you know, it affects their competitive concerns. But I just want to make sure that all the small communities are being respected and are on board with this. So thank you.
Representative Bonner, you want to sum up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. You know, I think the one thing that we want to point out, in addition to the fact that there is no cost, that this is bipartisan, is that this organization has a 100% positive track record. And this bill in particular represents a very strategic and very measured approach to growth within that entity so that we can do this in a responsible manner. And certainly I appreciate the question about 501(c)(3)s, but I think this is the right path, right? We want to make sure that we are being good stewards of these agencies and that things are done right. And when I talk to Barry about this extensively, I hear that come through loud and clear. That their mission is to do the absolute best they can for those that they serve, to make sure that they are able to do these projects that have a greater appeal in our communities that might be more difficult, and to do so in a cost-effective manner that is responsible. And so I am appreciative of the time today before the committee and would love to have your support.
Members, I saw two people signify they want to say something. The next bill has people who have come a considerable distance to testify. So if you have something you wish to say, I'll go to Representative O'Neill first, but let's be brief.
I was just going to offer my support for the bill, and I'll be voting yes as the lead. I thought that was important to say. It's a first bill going through. And where I didn't hear where this is going from here.
It's going to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Wonderful. And also, Chair, thank you for providing fiscal notes at a timely fashion so that we can review them and see them. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Dorn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I'm hoping that this bill will also be coming to Human Services Finance because it touches some of the licensing facilities under the Human Services for Senior, the assisted living and some of the nursing homes. We've got a little bit of some few things that we wanted to address.
With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 355 be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, committee members.
Representative Keeler. House File 750, and I apologize for moving you around. We just had an issue with a member being in another committee, and I know you have, and I think Representative O'Neill is going to be a co-presenter on this. All right. So to House File 750.
Thank you, Chair and members. It's so exciting to be back in the higher education realm as a former committee member. This work is something that I'm extremely passionate about, and through that passion, House File 750 came about. One of my favorite parts about this is what we did in committee was we listened and we learned about the different education opportunities across the state. Bipartisanly, we decided this is something that is really important for us to invest in. And so Representative O'Neill and I are excited to present House File 750. It's a very simple bill with massive impacts in a positive way. As many of you may know, we have tribal colleges in this state. Three of them don't receive any state funding. But we do know that they have a statewide impact. For you, just for clarification, our tribal colleges, anybody can attend a tribal college. It doesn't need to be an enrolled member of a federally recognized tribe. I do know that sometimes that's just a piece of confusion. But these are really good schools out in western Minnesota. And so what this bill does is it's $3 million to all of the colleges, which would be $1 million to each college for operation and maintenance expenses. Some of the things that came out of the bipartisan effort is that if we're going to give money to the schools, we want them to tell us what they're doing with the money. Having some sort of reporting mechanism would make sense. Representative O'Neill was really open about that was a way that we can make this bipartisan so that, one, we can highlight what our tribal colleges are doing and really highlight the amazing work that they do, but also making sure that they're fiscally sound in the money that we help provide them. Also, this does not allow for any of the tribes' contributions that are already helping their tribal colleges. This is not to supplant any of that money.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really great to be here in collaboration. And let me just tell you a bit of why this is so of great interest to me. So I grew up in Bagley, and I always say I grew up kind of in the middle of three different reservations, and they happen to be these three. And so that's really incredibly important to me. I think I didn't do the number exactly, which is odd for me, I know, but I think about 20% of my classmates were Native because they mostly came from White Earth, but other places as well. The other thing that's really important to me is the attainment goal. So we talk so much in here about the attainment goal. The attainment goal is 70%, so that somebody, once they finish high school, has something after that, whether it's a licensure, certification, a two-year, or four-year. And right now, unfortunately, the Native American population in Minnesota is at 29%. Compare that to white is at 68%. So that's a huge gap. So I'm looking at anything and everything that we can do to make sure that as many of my friends and family and loved ones, I call you family if that's okay, not by blood, but by spirit, that they are a part of the workforce, that they're providing what we all need, because there's 169,000 job openings and not enough people to fill them. If every single person in the state of Minnesota that is on unemployment went into the workforce, we'd still have a hole of 150,000 job openings and no people to fill. So that's incredibly important. Why it's important for me that we're supporting the tribal colleges also is my experience when I worked at Deutschland Hilfsfund. So that was a German-headquartered place. I was the assistant director of the U.S. operation, and I got to travel all over the world. When we did humanitarian relief, we took care of orphans and widows, and we did a lot of things. And what was so poignant to me in my 20s and 30s working there, and I worked there about 7 years, is that we trusted the people on the ground, the national people on the ground. So if we were working in Colombia, we had a Colombian director. If we were in India, we had an Indian director, and so on and so on and so on, all over the world. And it was before we even talked about being culturally appropriate. I mean, this is like, this is just how we did things. And it was so incredibly successful. And the reason the trust but verify portion of this is important to me, because my entire job was to go not just meet the people, understand the projects that we worked on, but I actually did audits. And so all the money that we sent over, I sat down and actually went through receipts and made sure that everything balanced. And so this is like the perfect balance to me of a bill that we haven't done. We've never supported them in this way with O&M, and I just feel like it's time. And the workforce issue is a big problem. The attainment is a big problem. And you're near and dear to my heart. So for all those reasons, I'm here to support.
Representative Kidder, do you want to bring down at least one testifier?
Sure. I moved a chair so that we can get through all of this. So we'll maneuver enough, and then we have two of our tribal colleges presidents here. They'll be able to tell you more about their colleges.
Helen. Yeah. Yeah. We can swing another chair over there, too, if they both want. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, thank you. I'm President Montgomery from Leech Lake Tribal College. So I will, thank you. I like standing, though, walking around, moving around. All right, thank you, Chair Pawlowski. I think you have one of those last names that I have that people struggle with, so they don't say it.
they do, and the previous House member had it, too, but you noticed that it was pronounced correctly.
Pawlowski, right?
Pawlowski.
Pawlowski.
One L, not two.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having us here. And I know that I heard that there are some new members of this committee, so I'm going to try to respect everyone's time. I think we have about 6 minutes, so I'll make it this very quick. So I want to talk about what it is that we do, and I do want to ask for your support for this funding. And part of the reason why we need this funding is really and truly, I know people use the word transformative a lot, but this would be really transformative to our colleges. So tribal colleges are community colleges. We're two-year colleges. In Minnesota, we're two-year colleges. There are others in the nation who are four-year colleges. But really, we are unique in the sense that we were started, when the tribal colleges were started, we were started based on ceremony, prayer, and culture. We were started as an answer to a prayer by Native American parents who wanted to have an educational opportunity for their children in their own communities. And so I work every day to keep that mission in the forefront of my mind. And thank you, representatives, for helping us with this. I'm sorry, I forgot to thank you when I came up. But anyone can attend our colleges. These, as was mentioned earlier, these colleges are not only for Native American people. At any given time, we have about between 8 and 20 on average, 15% of our students are non-beneficiary students, is what they're federally called, but they're students who are not enrolled or descendant of enrolled tribal members. We partner with our tribes. We have, through the COVID pandemic, transformed ourselves to have education available online. We provide supports to our students in terms of technology, transportation, housing, assistance, childcare. We really meet our students where they are. Our three nations, the big three, White Earth, Red Lake, and Leech Lake, make up approximately 70% of the Native American peoples in the state of Minnesota. And as you know that, as you probably all know, and I'm a numbers person too, the census really largely undercounts Native American populations for various reasons, but we have about 48,000 of 70,000 individuals who live in our nations. And so my colleague President King put this together, and I really do believe that we have kind of this secret sauce recipe to success. Next year, Leech Lake Tribal College will be turning 30 years old. And recently in our collective consciousness and education, we've had this term of equity, right? We talk about equity. And so I feel like we as tribal colleges have been providing equitable education for years and decades now. And the way that I always talk about our college is not that we just give students shoes, we give students shoes that fit them. When our students come through the door, we meet them where they are. Sometimes for our students, student success is just coming through that door and asking for a college application. And sometimes student success is finishing college and moving on to fill those places like the BIPOC teachers that we're talking about. We supply the state with police peace officers, early childhood teachers, and all kinds of other professionals. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague President King now, and he will talk a little bit more in detail about the success that we've achieved as tribal colleges in the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Dan King, and I'm president of the Red Lake Nation College, and also very honored to be one of the hereditary chiefs of the Red Lake Nation. I wanted to also thank Representatives Keeler and O'Neill for their strong support on this. Without them, there's no way we would have come this far. We actually started working on this about 6 years ago, and so to be here today before all of you, I'm very honored and thankful. Here's kind of, I have a few slides here, and this is one of them that I think tells a lot of our story of how what we're doing at the tribal colleges is really working. And here's some statistics from the last few years, which shows persistence rate, as everyone knows in higher ed, is fall to spring. And the U.S. national average is about 75%. The most recent Minnesota number we had was about 69%, very close to that. And at Red Lake Nation College, our recent number was 85%. And this is all the while, typically, the numbers for Native Americans in higher education are usually dramatically lower. Our retention rate from fall to fall, national average about 61 for two-year schools. We weren't able to pull out an exact number for Minnesota, but I'm pretty confident in saying that it's somewhere between 61 and 56, right around where we are at the Red Lake Nation College. And you compare that to high school graduation, where in the U.S. national average, about 88%, Minnesota, very close to that in that range. And for Minnesota natives, 35 to 58%. And the 35% comes from Red Lake. So you can see that the students that are coming in, we have a tremendous challenge where they're coming in usually at about a 9th or 10th grade level at our Red Lake Nation College. And our challenge is to get them from 9th grade to junior in college in 2 years with less funding than everybody else. So it's almost, they call us a lot of times unfunded miracles, because we're doing all this with hardly any funding at all. So it's really impressive, I think. And our return on investment, and I come from the business world. I spent my whole career in business. So if you'd have told me 20 years ago I'd be president of a college, I'd say you're joking. Because I really didn't have much of an interest, but due to health reasons, I kind of ended up here, and it's been the greatest job I've ever had. You know, I've been here for 14 years in Red Lake doing this. But it's very satisfying work, and the return on investment would probably be the best $3 million that the state spends this year as far as an investment. As everyone knows, the gold standard in accreditation is regional accreditation, the Higher Learning Commission. So we have that, all our three colleges. So that means we're in the same academic arena as Notre Dame. We have to meet the same exact standards as Notre Dame does and these great universities that we're all aware of. We have the same exact standards that we meet. And we do have academic partnerships with all the state schools. So we worked out, we've kind of followed the Minsky system. When we created our colleges, we created them so that people can transfer easily into those schools. And through these articulation agreements, our students were a great feeder system for the state. So our students go for 2 years at our tribal colleges, and then we transfer to the state schools. We also have now, as many of you might know, free tuition for natives who are families' incomes are under $75,000. And that applies to a lot of our students. So this will greatly benefit tribal college students, where they can go to the tribal college and then transfer to the state schools. The student benefits and support, most of our students are low income and with an emphasis on grants. And because they are, our tuition rates have to stay low. We're about 140 to 195 a credit at our tribal colleges. And most of our students, because of that, end up finishing 2 years at least with zero debt. And that's while the four-year USA average for four-year debt in the country after a four-year degree is about $33,000. So that's impressive that we get them, we do all this, and we do it where the student has no debt, at least for the first 2 years. Once they transfer, they probably will have to have some debt. A lot of counseling, mentors, one-on-one help, but all that costs a lot extra. And our average class size is only 10. So most of our students are first generation, so they need that extra hand-holding and extra help. And we also provide students with a laptop and free internet access while they're at our schools. We started that during COVID, and it worked so well that we're going to keep doing it. We're also expanding to Minneapolis in the fall of 23. We're there right now. We have a site where we started offering courses, because we had so many members asking to participate from the Twin Cities. And we have 8,000 Red Lake members who live in the Twin Cities, and there's over 50,000 natives in the Twin Cities. It's one of the largest urban centers of natives in the country. And there's currently no tribal college serving the Twin Cities. And so once we do this, and we're already there right now, we will be one of the first tribal colleges in a major urban setting in the country. So I think Minneapolis and Minnesota could be proud of that. And if I just showed you one slide today, this would be the slide I would show you. If you said we can only show one slide. Here's the allocation from 21. The University of Minnesota system got about $684 million. which is about 18% of their budget. The OHE, the state system, $353 million, about 76% of their budget. And the three tribal colleges in Minnesota, $0 and 0%. As was mentioned, you know, this is 70% of the Minnesota natives. So the only three public higher ed schools in the state not receiving any direct funding for operations are Red Lake, Leech Lake, and White Earth. So the results of that underfunding really are that we have less staff and less infrastructure than mainstream schools. Many jobs are unfilled. Like right now, we have several openings. We just can't find people. And the biggest challenge is that they have to do two or three jobs, and we can only pay about 70% of what the state school systems pay. So it was difficult and challenging even before the pandemic, and now it's pretty much impossible. We serve high poverty, high need communities. We're in the poorest communities in the state, like Beltrami County, where Red Lake is up in northern Minnesota. So we have a tremendous lack of, and that's right where Red Lake and Leech Lake are located. So we have just a lot of all of this combined results in a lot of educational injustice. And I think one way to look at this is really, this is a big economic problem. Let's look at the tuition the University of Minnesota can charge. That funds about 26% of their budget because they can charge a decent tuition. And my daughter goes there, so I know it's about $32,000 we pay a year when you add everything in. But so the tuition is challenging. But the state school's tuition, theirs funds about 10% of their budget. Because we can't charge that much, our tuition rates are $140 to $190 a credit. So that only funds about 3 to 5% of our budget. So our tribes, our grants, and donations, that's really what supports us. But without Minnesota support, I mean, just look at the numbers. From the University of Minnesota with their tuition and the funding that they can get, and the state systems with the tuition and the state funding that they get, that's 50 to 75 to 90% of their budgets come from those two areas. And we only get 3 to 5% of our budget from that. So we're missing two big pieces of the pie just to operate. So that's why the state funding would be a tremendous impact for us. And those bills are HF 750 and on the Senate side, 636. So we're asking for your strong support in getting this approved to make a big impact in our college. Miigwech.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this forward. It was a great opportunity to come visit Red Lake and learn so much about the college there. I know when I was starting my college journey, looking at the tribal colleges was one of the things that got me, like, interested and thinking, oh, I could maybe go to college. I didn't end up going to a tribal college, regretfully, but I just really appreciate your presence here. This is an education equity issue. As a state that's 100% treaty territory, it is unreal that we do not provide equitable funding to your colleges, and I think an apology is due for that. And I think this should be not just funded this year, but in perpetuity going forward to continue to support the great work that you do, not just for Indigenous communities, but for all of rural Minnesota and everybody who's underserved. So thank you again, and I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Question for the President. You do so much with so little and with so much success. We've seen our MinSCU systems in U of M with such large budgets. They do some great work, but there's a lot of failure and mistakes as well coming with that big budget. How will this change your secret sauce? Will it only get more secret and better?
President Kim.
Thank you for the question. Yeah, I think it will make it better. It'll allow us to do a better job and hire more people and take the stress off our teams, which really, I think, you know, a lot of times I feel like we're on the verge of, just a meltdown, basically, because we're doing too much, you know. So I think this will help us serve more people and do what we do even better, where we can add staff that we don't have right now and compete basically in the marketplace of people. As we all know from the economy right now, it's difficult hiring anybody. I think we have three or four positions open, And when you're competing against companies, like, you know, we have some companies in our area like Polaris and Articat and DigiKey, and when they're paying people $20, $22 an hour to start, it's hard to compete with that, you know, with a lot of our entry-level positions. So, yeah, I think it'll make a huge impact on us, our ability to compete.
President King and President Montgomery, this bill is a permanent base adjustment, so it is a significant investment in your colleges, which is much needed. I'll go to the two. Oh, Representative McDonald, do you have another follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Very impressive, your presentation, and I thank you and I support this completely. But a warning to the wise, be careful not to happen what other schools I have witnessed over the 13 years here. The more state money that the U got and the Minsk U got, the higher their tuition went. But I think you guys got the secret sauce to keep that working and keep tuition low. So great work.
Thank you.
Members, the next bill has individuals from out of town, too, so I'm going to turn it back to the authors for a final brief summary, and then we'll go to the next bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could, and then end it with Representative Keeler.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to paint us a picture. So, you know, I appreciate, Representative, your story. And Clearwater County, which is where I grew up, which is where Bagley is, Monoman County, which is where White Earth is, are either the first or second poorest in our state. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly poor. Beltrami County, which is right next door, which is where Red Lake is, and Cass County, which is right next door to that, are incredibly, incredibly poor. This is, I actually was really taken aback at how much the local community is supporting it already, and I don't know how. I honestly do not know how they are doing that and supporting this work, because I grew up there, I still go back there, I have family that's there, and I don't know how. So I'm really, really impressed, even more so before I was before today. But thank you, Mr. Chair, for this time, and I couldn't support it more, and I appreciate you giving us this opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair and members, for giving us the time. When they travel a long ways and they have a lot of things to say, they like to take the time to do that. So I appreciate you creating the space for that. I really look at this as creating a braid. You know, for us as Indigenous people, braids are extremely sacred, but they're also thick and they're very firm and they're very long. And so part of it is that adding the state funding just creates the last strand of the braid that can make this a really strong funded program to move forward. And we appreciate your support. Thanks.
Representative Keeler, this is an extremely high priority for this committee, just so you know.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
The next bill on the agenda, House File 687, Representative Cleborn, and she has guests, too, that have traveled a distance. So. Representative, to your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your, I'm going to be very brief so that our testifiers have an opportunity to speak, if that's all right with you. So I'll just go to a condensed version of my initial presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today I'm here to present House File 687, a bill that aims to address a major gap in higher education by expanding post-secondary options for people with intellectual disabilities. This bill is a continuation of work that was started by Representative Pryor in 2019. The bill does two things. It creates an inclusive higher education technical assistance center that will provide expertise and implementation in support of institutions providing inclusive higher education. And it also creates a competitive grant funding 2- and 4-year colleges and universities to start inclusive higher education initiatives. Nationally, we know that the outcomes speak for themselves. Students with intellectual disabilities who attend post-secondary education are more than twice as likely to be employed, live in their own homes, and rely less on government supports like SSI and vocational rehab. This legislation will strengthen the Minnesota workforce, reduce dependence on more formal, costly supports, and lead to long-term cost savings for the state. More importantly, it will ensure that Minnesotans with intellectual disabilities have an opportunity to study in Minnesota and to pursue their dreams and live the life of their choice and have a feeling and a sense of belonging in the communities where they come from. That's my truncated version. So I will ask you then if you will just move to testifiers and then we can answer questions.
And who's first?
Well, starting with Dr. Brian Valenti, a faculty at St. Cloud University, State
Welcome
University.
To the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, and thank you for having me today. My name is Dr. Brian Valentini, and I'm an assistant professor of special education at St. Cloud State University. I'm here to support inclusive higher education and the efforts to advance House File 687. I would like to start by establishing the why House File 687. In Minnesota, individuals with cognitive disabilities earn approximately $16,000 per year, which is far below the median income. Only one in 40 individuals with a cognitive disability enroll in a college course. That's simply enrolling, not graduating. Unemployment rates for individuals with developmental disabilities exceed 50%. One in six individuals remain at home unemployed up to 8 years after leaving high school. The outcomes for individuals with disabilities are bleak. Still, of 100 families and individuals surveyed in the greater St. Cloud area, 88 stated that they wish to attend college. Further, 80% of Minnesota parents want their son or daughter with an intellectual disability to attend college. 80% of parents nationwide want their son or daughter to be employed in competitive and integrated workplaces. Minnesota and the people with disabilities that reside in the state want and need avenues to improve the aforementioned outcomes. Inclusive higher education is one avenue. Yet, Minnesota is one of only two states remaining that do not have a four-year option for individuals with an intellectual disability. The inclusive higher education initiatives discussed in the legislation before you are not new. Some colleges across the country have enrolled students with intellectual disabilities for more than a decade. As such, much research has been conducted on those college options. In these post-secondary education offerings, retention rates exceed 80%. Placement in competitive and integrated employment exceeds 70%. Student high school graduation rates exceed 75%. Certificate or degree completion exceeds 70%. The numbers resulting from inclusive higher education enrollment are astounding. At St. Cloud State University, we have worked with five local school districts, six administrative offices, and over 100 families to create a model program for our university, campus, city, and state. The legislation before you would dramatically increase enrollment, increase the workforce development, and enhance the quality of life of hundreds of individuals with disabilities. I'm asking that you support House File 687 and support it all the way into action. And I thank you for your time.
Your next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our next testifier is Gage Robinson, and he is from Cannon Falls.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Chair. Okay. Chair Pulowski and committee members. My name is Gage Robinson. Thank you for the chance to testify in support of inclusive higher education and House File 687. I recently completed high school. One of my goals is to go to college. I am interested in public speaking, web design, nonprofit organization, and cabinet making. I want to explore careers in my interest areas. School has not always been easy for me. When I was younger, I spent most of my day in a self-contained classroom with other students with disabilities. I love to learn, I just learned differently, and I need more time. I love being in class with peers and friends without disabilities. I really enjoyed my woodworking class. I want to go to college, be with students my age, and be a part of the campus community. Today there are no Minnesota college options that are good. Fit for me. I need more choices to go to college. And be successful. Inclusive higher education will provide me college access and the supports that I need. I want to be seen as capable. I am. I want to keep learning. I am a lifelong learner. I am more than a disability. I am a nephew, a friend, an athlete, a public speaker, a nonprofit leader, and a woodworker, and a prospective college student. I need the opportunity to go to college. I can be successful and have the career of my choice. I ask you, or I ask for your support for the Minnesota Inclusive Higher Education Act, like me. All Minnesotans with an intellectual disability are worth it. I ask that you support the House File 687. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Next testifier. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski and committee members. My name is Mary Hoff, and I'm testifying in support of House File 687. I'm a parent advocate and co-leader of the Minnesota Inclusive Higher Education Consortium. My testimony today focuses on why House File 687 deserves your support. Students with intellectual disabilities are capable, lifelong learners who want to continue their education through college. Gage's testimony and the submitted written testimony are representative of the 5,000 college students or college-aged Minnesotans with intellectual disabilities. Brian's testimony earlier also talks about and underscores the student interest in the St. Cloud area and how that is representative across the state. Unfortunately, today, less than 3% of college-age Minnesotans with intellectual disabilities have access to college in Minnesota, woefully short of Minnesota's 70% attainment rate goal. That is the first reason why House File 687 deserves your support. Inclusive higher education is about opening access to post-secondary education and widening the pathway to prosperity. Students with intellectual disabilities have diverse interests and strengths and need the same choices and access as their peers without disabilities. Students with intellectual disabilities who attend college experience higher employment rates, earn higher wages, live more independently, and experience healthier and happy lives. This is the second reason why House File 687 deserves your support. Colleges and universities with an inclusive higher education initiative benefit from including students with intellectual disabilities. The campus community becomes more welcoming and accepting. Faculty gain instructional strategies through universal design for learning that helps the success of all their students. This is the third reason why you should support House File 687. Minnesotans with intellectual disabilities who earn post-secondary credentials are part of the solution of Minnesota's workforce shortage and will contribute to Minnesota's economic growth. They are capable and untapped. This is the fourth reason why House File 687 deserves your support. Inclusive higher education is a nationwide movement that started in 2008. Minnesota lags behind. States that have made a similar investment as proposed in House File 687 have experienced significant growth in post-secondary education options for students with intellectual disabilities. House File 687 provides the framework for inclusive higher education in Minnesota. This is the fifth reason why House File 687 deserves your support. Expanding college initiatives to include students with intellectual disabilities is possible right now. Over 50 faculty from 27 different Minnesota colleges and universities are interested in inclusive higher education. However, new resources are critical. With the grant funding and Minnesota-based technical assistance that colleges and universities need, that positive momentum will continue. I ask for your support for House File 687. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. Chair, thank you so much, Representative, for bringing this forward. This is a huge passion area of mine. As a person with a disability who used supports in college for a learning disability, I know how challenging accessing higher education can be with a disability. But as a disability advocate and someone who worked really closely when we tried to do something similar in my community without significant support, I have really, really strong support for a bill like this. A bill like this is what inclusion is. This is what inclusion looks like. We cannot have inclusion if inclusion does not exist in all spaces. True inclusion is inclusion in preschools and daycares and elementary schools and middle schools and high schools and higher ed and the workplace and our apartment buildings and our neighborhoods and our whole community. True inclusion means everyone has the choice to pursue their dreams and their goals. And I thank you for bringing that choice to Minnesota, and I thank you both for being here today. And I am looking forward to a world where my children are in college in a truly inclusive environment.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Representative Cleaborn and to the testifiers. We met in my office earlier and I appreciate that conversation. Mr. Robinson, it's so nice to hear your testimony and your interest. Thank you for sharing that with us. I am interested in this bill, but I have to say I'm still on the fence. My nephew has a disability and has been to one of the three colleges in Minnesota that currently offers this program. Yes, it is. There are three. Could you confirm that to the testifier?
Currently, there are three colleges and universities that have that CTP designation from the U.S. Department of Ed. What we're offering and the bill is proposing is something more robust than what's currently offered in Minnesota.
Yes, and under this bill, would all three that currently offer this and are kind of in a head start be eligible?
Yes.
Let's go through the chair.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Novel way of just communicating. So, Ms. Huff, you want to respond?
Sorry, Chair Pawlowski. Yes, that is correct. They would be eligible for the grant funding.
Representative Robin.
Thank you. Well, then I would just like to, ask that be really clear in the language, because currently on 5.6 it says it's currently available for public post-secondary 2 or 4 year institutions. And in other sections of the bill, it says all Minnesota higher institutions. So I would just ask that someone work on that.
Representative Cleaborn has a response for it.
I do. And thank you, Representative Robbins, for that. The Senate, when they heard it, they've amended the language to be more clear. And if this bill moves to the floor or goes to conference, we would be willing to adopt the Senate language. But thank you for the clarification.
And members, remember, the committee is in possession of these bills, so you can certainly work on language, and we can bring the bills back up, and we can do whatever needs to be done to make them better. So they're here with us. Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleaborn, for bringing this bill forward. I just want to highlight and thank our testifier for coming forward today, because when people with disabilities stand up and say, I have a right to self-determination, I have a right to determine where I want to go and be well-supported and welcomed in my environment, these are just the ways that we as legislators hear your stories and turn that into policy. We have to embrace our right and responsibility to help make sure everybody has the opportunity to participate with others in a shared public life and to achieve the goals that they set for themselves. So thank you, Chair, for hearing this bill today, and thank you, Representative Cleveland, for bringing it forward, and thank you most to our testifier for being brave enough to share your story and come before us today.
Thank you very much. I would just like to say that I appreciate you, Chair Pawlowski, letting us bring the bill forward. As I said, this was a bill that initially started with Representative Pryor in 2019. It's been worked. It's been tweaked. We're still willing to make sure that we accommodate the needs of the committee, whatever that might look like. The goal is that students with intellectual disabilities have the same number of choices as other Minnesotans have. So whether it's region, whether it's type of class, but it's really important for them to be able to stay in their communities and be near the support systems that help them be successful. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming today. Mr. Robinson, you did an excellent job of presenting your bill. Thank you much. Members, on Tuesday, we're going to hear the request I made about 2 weeks ago to the Minn State system. They are going to do a campus-by-campus breakdown of if we fully funded their request, what the impact would be on each campus, and they're also going to do a campus-by-campus analysis of if we gave them the governor's request. So I would hope you would attend. I think you will be surprised by the numbers, campus by campus. So with that, meeting is adjourned.